touch her in places that had belonged only to him, breathing into her hair. How many times had they done it? Where? He had wakened once in a drenching sweat, wondering if they were having sex right then, at that very moment. It had been humbling to discover his capacity for violence and revenge. He'd acknowledged this, like all good analysts, in a theoretical way while studying Jung's concept of the personal and collective shadow. But he knew it now as a living reality. He had stopped envisioning himself going to the monastery and taking the man by the throat, but he did not deny there were moments he wanted the monk to choke and bleed. He would never act on it, of course, but even the wanting to, the needing to, expelled cherished notions he'd held about himself. He was not special. He was not entitled. His goodness, his enlightenment, did not set him apart. He was like all the rest, carrying around the same huge quantities of darkness. The knowledge of this had driven him down into his own humanity. Once in a while, when he was capable of seeing himself as more than the pain he felt, he'd hoped his suffering was not being squandered, that somewhere inside it was making him pliant and tender. The woman across the room from him, he realized, was explaining the details of her dog's death.
"He was in such pain. Just to pick him up made him yelp. So the vet came to the car to give him the shot. Abercrombie was lying on the back seat, and when he saw Dr. Yarbrough, do you know what he did?"
Hugh shook his head.
"He looked up at him and wagged his tail. Can you believe that?"
Yes, Hugh thought. He could believe that. When Jesse had called him that Sunday and asked him to come, he'd gone just like the damn stupid dog, wagging his tail. He'd thought he was going to a reconciliation. He'd thought whatever had come over her had run its course. It had been easy to see how much she'd changed. She looked tired and frazzled from the ordeal with Nell, but underneath, he'd sensed aliveness. There was an unmistakable independence taking hold, a self-containment that hadn't been there before. He'd seen how her paintings had changed, too, exploding out of their little boxes, becoming bold excerpts of the mystifying process she was in. In the past, so much of her had been invisible to him. Looking at her in the hospital waiting room after being apart from her for so long, he'd been able to see her again. How often did we do that, he wondered. Look at someone and fail to see what's really there. Why had it been so hard to look at his wife and understand his need for her? The way his life was held in the accumulation of moments they'd shared. He looked at the woman in front of him and tried for a second to see her. She was telling him now about the pet cemetery. He touched the odd little bracelet on his wrist. The last time Dee had phoned had been his birthday.
"When is Mom coming home?" she'd asked.
He'd paused. Too long.
"Something's wrong, isn't it? She's been there forever."
"I won't lie to you, honey. We're having a few problems," he'd told his daughter. "But nothing that serious, okay? Every marriage has them. We'll work it out."
5 days later, the bracelet had arrived. She'd made it herself. He didn't know what to tell Dee now. He didn't know what to tell himself. He looked at the clock in the office just over the woman's head. He dreaded the end of the day. At night, Jesse's paintings haunted him, waking him up. He would sit on the side of the bed, remembering how the colors had grown fiercer the farther the woman went. Last night, desperate to alleviate his anguish, he tried to look at what Jesse had done not as a husband, but as a psychiatrist. The impulse was ludicrous, but the analytical thinking had given him a hallowed hour or two of distance from his torment. It had aerated his emotions, generated a measure of perspective. He was grateful for every small mercy. What he'd done was go to his study and flip around in various books, reading and jotting notes. Over and over he'd come across the same idea, not the least bit unfamiliar to him, that when a person was in need of cataclysmic change, of a whole new center in the personality, for instance, his or her psyche would induce an infatuation, an erotic attachment, an intense falling in love. He knew this. Every analyst knew it. Falling in love was the oldest, most ruthless catalyst on earth. But typically, you fell in love with something missing in yourself that you recognized in the other person. Yet he couldn't grasp what Jesse had seen in this supposedly spiritual man that could capture her so profoundly. After almost an hour of this kind of thing, he'd shoved his notes back in the drawer and returned to bed. It had suddenly felt like a lot of abstract drivel. He didn't want to apply any of it to Jessie. He didn't want to bring the grace of understanding into it. Her reasons were unforgivable, no matter how powerful they were. His wife had been with another man. She had betrayed him. And even if she came to him begging, he didn't know if he could ever take her back.
"Dr. Sullivan?" his patient said.
He had pivoted away from her toward the window, his elbow on the chair arm, his chin on his fist, and was staring at the outline of the Bradford pear tree flowering profusely against the pane. His eyes were burning with tears. Turning toward the woman, he felt intense embarrassment. She handed him the tissue box she'd been cradling, and he took one and awkwardly dabbed at his eyes. "I'm sorry," he said. He shook his head, astonished at himself.
"No, please," she said, crossing her hands one on top of the other at her neck. "Don't apologize. I'm touched."
She thought his tears were for her, for her dachshund. She was smiling at him, awestruck by his godlike heart. He didn't know how to tell her his emotion had nothing to do with her, that in fact he was being the worst possible psychiatrist at the moment. "We all fail one another," he said. The woman's eyes widened as she cast around for his meaning. "I have failed my wife," he added. Jesse had failed him, yes, horribly. But he'd failed her, too. He had carelessly glossed over her. He had not given her the small kindness of letting her grow into herself.
"I have failed people," the woman said, as if he were trying out an innovative new approach and she was joining in.
"You mean your brother?" he said gently, and heard the sob break loose in her and fill the room. Chapter 33. I brought Mother home from the hospital on St. Sonara's Day, Saturday, April 30th. A day flooded with brightness. After 13 days in the hospital, Mother had made enough progress to come home, which seemed to mean she was medicated enough not to hurt herself again. According to the nurse, she'd been pleasant without exhibiting aberrant behavior, but had refused to open up. "These things take time," the nurse had explained. Then given me a slightly patronizing talk on the importance of Mother's coming back weekly to see her psychiatrist and faithfully swallowing her pills. As I boarded the ferry early that morning, preparations for St. Sonara's Day were already underway. One of the monks was on all fours at the edge of the dock, laying out a rectangle of coral-colored carpet on which the mermaid chair would sit after its winding procession from the abbey. When I was a girl, the carpet had invariably been red, though one year it had turned up pink and fringed, with the suspicious look of a bath mat, which set off a small controversy. A folding table had been set up, and Shem's wife, Mary Eva, was setting out boxes of mermaid tears, which would be thrown into the sea during the ceremony. Crossing the bay, I thought of the mermaid tears I'd kept on top of the crab trap in Witt's Hermitage. I hadn't been out there since Mother had gone to the hospital. Nor had I seen Whit. Not once in 2 weeks. I'd sent him a note, passed along by Cat, explaining I would be spending my days at the hospital with Mother and wouldn't be able to see him for a while. He had not sent a note back. He had not walked to the edge of Mother's backyard and looked over the brick wall and called me out of the house. I was there alone each night, and he didn't come. Maybe he suspected that my note didn't tell the whole story. Perhaps he detected the sadness beneath my words. The morning after I'd confessed my affair to Hugh, I'd found his wedding ring on the pincushion along with mine, and no trace of him in the house. I'd rushed out, wanting to catch him at the ferry dock before he left the island. But by the time I reached the slave cemetery, I thought better of it. I remembered the way he'd recoiled, almost violently, when I'd reached for him. The rage in his voice when he told me to get away. He had said it with his teeth clenched. His eyes had looked so pained, so shocked. I did not recognize him. It seemed now I could at least spare him the fresh sight of me. I could do that much for him. Depression had descended then like a great fatigue, and I'd sat down beside the graves and watched a dove scratch the dirt, making small, neglected sounds that were heartbreaking to me. It was as if someone had suddenly handed me a huge stone, the weight of all the suffering I'd caused, and said, "Here, you must carry this now." So I had, these 13 days. It is still hard for me to understand, much less explain, the descent that comes with necessary loss, how requisite it is. It came to me like the darkening of the day. It wasn't that I rued what I'd done, that I wanted a reversal of some kind. I would not have taken back the way my loving wit had impregnated me with life, with myself, the 100 ways I'd been broken and made larger. It's that I saw the effect of it. I saw it in the immortal hurt in Hugh's eyes, in the bracelet Dee had woven for him, in the unbearable ceremony our rings were performing on the pincushion. Each morning I'd left the island and returned in the late afternoon. I'd sat with Mother in what they called the day room, with its television and sofas and strange shuffling people. It had reminded me of Dante's Purgatorio, which I'd read in school. The only part of the story I remembered was the inhabitants lugging huge stones around a mountain. I'd watched the medicines make Mother docile, watched everything from a place of fallowness and grief, always going back to the moment when Hugh saw through it all and posed his question. It stupefied me daily that I'd answered him without hesitation, using Witt's monk name, as if underscoring his spiritual credentials, as if that somehow made what we were doing loftier. Mother had sat each day with her body slackened on the chair, moving her fingers around the Rubik's Cube that I'd brought her from home. She'd asked me so many times about her finger, I'd finally brought that too. I'd washed it under the faucet one night, forcing myself to hold the lost piece of her in my palm and scrub the bloodstains. I'd brought it to her in a mason jar, submerged in rubbing alcohol so it wouldn't putrefy. I'd gotten permission for her to keep it in her room, but just in case, I'd written, "Do not throw away," on the side of the jar. In the evenings, I'd given progress reports to Cat and Hepzibah on the phone, warm soup from the cans in the pantry, and listened to the endless soliloquy of sadness and blame that went on and on inside me. Whenever I thought of Wit, I'd long to be with him. But I didn't know any more whether my wanting came from love or the simple need to be comforted. Despite that, I couldn't let myself be with him yet. It seemed perverse to make love with him, given the freshness of the pain Hugh was in, that we were both in. No doubt it was illogical, but I felt I was abstaining out of respect for the death of my marriage. Mother seemed excited as we left the hospital that afternoon. Inside the rental car, she pulled down the sun visor and dragged a comb through her white hair, then astonished me by dabbing on her old fire engine red lipstick. She blotted her lips on a gas receipt she found on the seat. It was a gesture of such normalcy that I smiled at her. "You look nice," I said, worried for a moment that she might respond by wiping the color off her lips, but she'd smiled back. The ferry was crammed with tourists. Not even standing room was left. Mother clutched the jar that held her finger like a child bringing a goldfish home from the store. I had wrapped it in a paper towel fastened with a rubber band, but she still got a few curious looks from the passengers. As we got closer, I could see the line of shrimp trawlers already forming on the southeast side of the island, out on the Atlantic. "It's St. Sinara's Day," I said to Mother.
"You think I don't know that?" she snapped.
She had not gone to the festivities since Dad died. As she had with the all-girls picnics, she'd simply eradicated them from her life. Her abolishing this one, however, had genuinely puzzled me. Sinara was, after all, her saint. Cat met us at the dock, smelling like the lavender lotion she used. Not Benny, just Cat. She kissed Mother on the cheek. I hadn't expected her. Mother inspected the dock, the boxes of mermaid tears, as well as a small table from the monastery with a silver cruet on top, the one used year after year to splash seawater across the mermaid chair. I watched her eyes search for the coral carpet at the dock's edge. Max was stretched out on it, as if the rug had been put there specifically for him. She stared at the wedge of carpet with something like revulsion in her face. And I imagined she was picturing the mermaid chair sitting on top of it.
"Let's take a walk," Cat said, grasping Mother by the arm. "You too, Jessie."
She whisked Mother across the dock, down to the sidewalk where I'd left the golf cart. I was about to slide behind the wheel, but Cat guided Mother on past it. I set her suitcase down on the seat and followed. I remember being aware of a small passing dread and pushing it aside. I didn't ask where we were going. I think I was under the impression Cat wanted to distract Mother from the moment on the dock when she'd seen the rug. I trailed behind them along the row of shops, past Caw Caw General and the Island Dog B&B, listening to Cat ply Mother with harmless questions. The smell of fried shrimp coming from Max's cafe was so thick the air felt oily. I checked my watch. It was 5 in the afternoon, the light slumping, the clouds veined with red. The day was taking on the first bloodshot look of sunset. The festivities would begin at 6, when every monk and islander who could walk would come pouring onto the dock behind the mermaid chair. Leading the parade, the abbot would be decked out in chasuble and stole and carrying his crozier. And somewhere in all that hoopla would be Wit. Beneath the striped awning of the mermaid's tail, Cat paused and, using her key, opened the door. The sign in the window said closed. Absurd as this sounds, not even then did it cross my mind that our stroll might have some purpose other than diverting Mother from whatever horrible old memory had settled over her back on the dock. Stepping inside the shop behind them, listening to the sounds on the street seep away, I noticed Hepzibah, Shem, and Father Dominic standing at the rear of the store near the cash register. Back there, with the boat wreck picture I'd painted when I was 11, the flames beneath the water, all the happy sea creatures. Dominic was not wearing his robe or his hat, but instead a suit with his priest's collar. Shem, flushed and constrained looking, had his arms folded across his barrel of a chest and his hands stuck under his armpits as if someone had forced him there at gunpoint. Apparently, catching sight of them at the same moment as I, Mother stopped in the middle of the store. She stood paralyzed, surrounded by Cat's great convocation of mermaids. They hung over her from the ceiling in the form of aluminum wind chimes and flanked her on all sides in an array of ceramic sculptures, necklaces, soap carvings, candles, and beach towels. I watched her begin to take small steps backward across the floor. Hepzibah hurried toward her with a funny mixture of determination and reluctance in her face, that look of moving toward what must be done. She lassoed Mother with both her arms, stopping her in her tracks.
"It's gonna be all right, Nell. I promise you. We're just gonna have a talk, okay?"
Even now, that image never leaves me.
Mother, standing in the dark circle of Hepzibah's arms, not moving a muscle, clasping her jaw with excruciating stillness. There were two sharp clicks, and I realized Cat had locked the door behind us. I swung around to her then. For heaven's sake! What's all this about? Groping for my hands, Cat held them tightly in front of her. I'm sorry, Jessie, she said. I haven't been honest with you. I'm an obstinate, know-it-all damn idiot of a woman who thought I was doing the right thing, and I guess what I've done is to make it worse. I drew my head back slightly, taking in her face. It had the look of ice about to break. Her eyes were tightened, her mouth hitched to the side to keep from crying, and I knew what it must have taken for her to say these words. I felt myself bracing for what lay behind them. It's just, I swear to you, I didn't think Nell was as bad off as she was. But why are we here? The day we were up there in the hospital waiting room, I realized if I didn't at least try to get everything out in the open, Nell was going to end up bleeding to death one night. If remembering is what she needs, like you and Hugh said, then okay. By God, we are going to sit here and remember. My mind spun. It was slowly dawning on me. Cat, Hepzibah, Dominic, Shem, all of them knew. They knew the reason Mother had mutilated herself, why my father's death had more or less ended my mother's life, too, even why his pipe was buried in her drawer and not in the ocean. These things had been like hibernating cicadas that live in the ground for 17 years, and then one day, when the circadian wheel turns, all come crawling up into the light of day. I glanced back at Dominic, who met my gaze, lifting the sides of his mouth in a tempered smile, trying to reassure me. They'd known for 33 years. When I was a little girl and had painted the boat wreck, when I'd gathered roses in the monastery garden and scattered them like my father's ashes across the island, every time I'd come back to visit, they had known. Hepzibah had settled Mother into one of the folding chairs near the counter. The jar, I noticed, had been tugged away from her and stood between the cash register and a display of sugarless gum. Mother sat with what struck me as remarkable resignation. Hepzibah had not worn any kind of headdress today, but had done her hair in cornrows. I stared at her a moment as she worked a finger along the little hedges, her other hand patting Mother's arm. The last time I'd sat over there, Cat, Hepzibah, and Benny had been eating butter pecan ice cream. Standing at the door next to Cat, I considered for the first time that what they were doing, this so-called remembering, as Cat had put it, might not be good for Mother. I couldn't believe that I, of all people, was thinking this after everything I'd had to say. But what if the truth overwhelmed her, caused her to break down again, to curl up in a ball on the floor? I leaned over to Cat, keeping my voice low. I want Mother to confront things as much as anyone does, but is this the right way to go about it? I mean, she just got out of the hospital. I called Hugh this morning, Cat said. Hugh? I said his name and felt it magnify in the room, the way it sucked up the air. I wouldn't be doing this if he hadn't said it was okay, she assured me. Actually, he seemed to think it was a fairly brilliant idea. Really? I acted surprised, but I could easily see how he would rally behind this. Loving friends gathering around Mother, helping her confront the thing that was slowly destroying her. Cat said, Hugh suggested we just talk with her like friends, not push her too much. She has to be the one to say it. It, And did you explain to him what it was? I asked. She looked away from me. I told him everything.
Oh, but you couldn't tell me?
My voice was filled with exasperation and anger.
You have to ambush me along with Mother?
She shook her head, making the wisps of her hair float around her face. I could hear the others across the room murmuring in the quiet.
I don't blame you for being angry, Kat said, her testiness back.
Okay, I deserve it. I do believe we've settled that. But do me a favor and do not call this an ambush, whether you want to believe it or not. It comes out of love for Nell and nothing else.
She stood there, gesticulating, small and tough, and I did not doubt she loved my mother, that she had carried around my mother's misery these last 33 years as if it somehow belonged to her, too.
It was you who convinced me we all needed to talk about this, she railed. Plus Nell up there in a hospital bed with one more finger chopped off. I would have told you about it sooner, but it took me until last night to work it all out in my head. I didn't know if I could go through with it till this morning.
I took a breath, feeling myself give way. Annoyed she had turned to Hugh, but relieved at the same time. Kat began to unruffle herself.
Hugh said Nell was stabilized on medicine now, and that even her doctor thinks she's ready to go back and look at what started everything.
So, I thought, Hugh had stayed in touch with Nell's doctor. Kat and I went over and sat down, me next to Mother, while Shem and Dominic took the last two chairs.
I didn't know anything about this, I told Mother.
If you don't hate me already, you will, she responded.
Nobody is going to hate anybody, Kat said. I realize getting you here wasn't the most straightforward thing in the world, but the fact is, we need to do this.
Mother stared into her palms, cupped like small basins on each of her knees.
Look, I stopped at your house and got your rosary, Kat said.
She reached in her pocket, drew out the red beads and coiled them into Mother's good hand. She closed her fingers around them.
What do you want me to do?
Just try to put what happened with Joe into words, Dominic told her.
We waited. My heart began to beat convulsively. I didn't want to know. I'd more or less pushed everyone into this, and now I felt undone at the thought of what it might be.
If you don't hate me already, you will.
Mother turned her head and looked at me, and it was like staring into a dark hatchway, so much black sorrow below.
I'm not going to hate you, I said. You need to talk about it, whatever it is.
I could see the chinks in her resistance. We all could. We sat there avoiding one another's eyes. The silence turned oceanic. Outside, the St. Sonora crowd that had come over on the ferry was beginning to line the sidewalk to wait for the mermaid chair. I could see a cluster of them through the plate glass window at the front, imagining them out there doing the ordinary things people did, window shopping, licking snow cones, lifting their children onto their shoulders. These acts of daily grace filled me with the ache one has for such seeming insignificance only when it goes missing. I wanted everything to be ordinary again, to walk around with a glorious nonchalance reserved for oblivious people.
Your father, he was ill,
Mother said. The words spit into the middle of us like the hard, bitter pit of some fruit she'd been eating. She paused and looked toward the door.
Nell, Dominic said, go ahead and say it. We'll all be the better for it. Do it for yourself and for Jesse. Do it for our blessed Saint Sonara.
Immediately, the room filled with brilliance. It was only the sun dropping through fathoms of sky, hitting the window and bombarding us with light beams, but in that way of magical thinking, it seemed as if Sonara had lifted her hand to bless Dominic's words, causing light to rise and scatter. Mother crossed herself.
"It was the same disease his father had," she said. She was resolved now. It was hardened in her eyes. "It's called Pick's disease."
She stared at the hardwood planks on the floor as if directing her story to them, but clearly she was talking to me.
"When he was a little boy, Joe watched his own father, your grandfather, grow senile and die with it. Back then, though, they just called it dementia. It wasn't till Joe got diagnosed with it that they realized what kind of dementia his father probably had."
I shut my eyes. Pick's disease. I'd never even heard of it. I could feel the ground swell, the whirling up of grief. In my mind, I saw Boneyard Beach, with gale wind surging off the water and ripping into the dunes, knowing that it would rearrange the island into new contours.
"When we first met, Joe told me about his father, how the disease destroyed his brain."
She spoke in a halting, heavy way, each word laid down like a brick she was trying to lift and place just right.
"But I don't think it ever entered his mind that he could get it. There's just the smallest tendency for it to run in families. He just talked about how there wasn't a cure. That kind of thing."
She crossed herself again. Tears were beading up in the gray floss of her lashes. She said,
"One time, his father got him mixed up with a boy he'd known growing up. It nearly killed Joe. Later, his father couldn't place him at all. The disease completely ate his memory.
That's how Joe always put it.
Like it was devouring his father from the inside out. It got where he couldn't talk right, and the spit would run out of his mouth. At the end, Joe's mother was always mopping his chin, and finally she put a bib on him."
She was leaning forward in her chair, her words suddenly pouring out in a turbulent stream. It seemed that finding a crack, the force of the story had thrown the door wide open. "In the beginning, he said it was mostly his father's personality that started changing. He did things, real odd things. He'd shout at people on the street for no good reason, or blurt out something crazy. A lot of times, it would be something lewd, like he'd lost all his inhibitions. But the part that got stuck the worst in Joe's head was the day his father knocked him onto the floor. When he saw what he'd done, he started crying. 'I'm sorry, little boy. I'm sorry.' Like he didn't know who he was. Joe broke down every time he remembered it. I think it was a relief when his father finally died. He was 10 years old, and his father just 48. Her eyes looked shrunken, tiny almonds in her face. The big crucifix on the end of the rosary hung off the edge of her lap, swaying slightly as she worked the beads with her fingers in the accomplished way of old nuns. Hepzibah reached over and patted her arm, her hands, the lumps and dough of her skin, wanting, it seemed, to mold her back together.
"Go on. Tell the rest now."
Mother wiped at her eyes.
"Joe came to me one day and said he was sure he had his father's disease. He'd been out in the boat, and when he tried to throw out the anchor line, he couldn't remember where he kept it, or even how to say the words anchor line in his head. He was so confused he came straight back to the dock, afraid he'd forget where that was. I can still see his face when he walked through the kitchen door.
How pale and scared it was. He said, God help me, Nell. I have the disease. He knew it, and I think I did too. There had been other signs, little things slipping his mind. Plus he'd been losing his temper over nothing and just not thinking straight.
A few months later, the doctors in Charleston told us what we already knew. She did not look at us. She made a little altar of the floor, of the light shafts, of the granules of dust illuminated inside them, and concentrated her eyes upon it. Your father did not want to forget your name, she said.
And I could hear the desperation in her voice, the ragged way it sounded in her throat.
He did not want to forget Mike's name either.
But it was your name, Jesse, that he would wake up shouting. Sometimes he would bolt out of his sleep crying, I'm sorry, little girl. I'm sorry.
She rocked her body back and forth, and I knew in my bones that's what she must have done when he woke like that. Taken him in her arms and rocked back and forth with him. I couldn't bear watching her. My mind went to the time I found my mother and father in the kitchen, dancing without music. They had poured so much love on each other.
I told him 1,000 times, you won't forget your children's names. I won't let you. God will cure you.
She had begun twisting the rosary in her hands. I slid forward and reached out to touch her. I wanted my mother. I wanted to bend over and kiss her the way a mother kisses her injured child. My love for her was such a rubble. The rosary fell onto the floor. She began talking to my father as if he were sitting in the room with us.
Don't ask me to do this, Joe. Please, don't ask me. I'll walk on my knees across the island if I have to. I won't eat. I'll sleep on the floor on the dirty ground. I'll make God hear me. Jesus and Mary, don't ask me to do this. It would be damnation for us.
Her face was blazing. The light on the floor had disappeared as if it had boiled away. Mother stared at the darkness rising around our feet, the quiet way the shadows pulled out from under the chairs. Cat reached down and picked up the rosary. None of us said a word. I had the blurred, disoriented feeling of floating, waving like an eel in the ocean. I could grasp nothing. What was she trying to say? I believe, though, part of me knew. I began pulling air down the chute of my throat, into my lungs, like stuffing cotton batting into a pillow that would soon absorb an unthinkable blow. Mother turned slowly to face me.
He wouldn't listen to me. Every time I refused to do it, he smiled and said,
Nell, it'll be okay. God won't blame you. Why, it's God's tender mercy you'll be dispensing. Let me have my dignity. Let me go the way I need to. I understood then. I think I must have made a sound, a moan. It caused them all to turn and stare at me. Even Mother. I felt awe at the sight of her.
I shouldn't have listened to him, Mother said. Why did I listen to him?
Dominic's eyelids were opening and closing repeatedly, and all I could think of was how thin they seemed, two bluish white films. I sat in amazement. The translucence that comes when life hardens into a bead of such cruel perfection, you see it with the purest clarity. Everything suddenly there. Life as it truly is. Enormous, appalling, devastating. You see the great sinkholes it makes in people and the harrowing lengths to which love will go to fill them. Mother had started to sob.
her head drooped toward her chest, heaving up and down with her shoulders. I reached for her hand, because it was there and it had to be taken. Because I both loved and hated her for what she'd done. But mostly, I pitied her. Her hand was leaden and damp. I touched the veins twisting toward her knuckles. "You did the only thing you could," I said. It was all I could manage, this concession, this forbearance. I wasn't sure if she would tell me how she did it, whether I wanted to know. I began to feel the first traces of relief. I looked at Dominic, silently moving his lips, and thought it was a prayer of thanksgiving that Mother's surrender to the past was finally over. I believe that as ghastly as the truth was, it was at least out. I believed it could not get worse. These were my mistakes. Hepzibah brought Mother a glass of water. We watched solemnly as she found her composure and drank it, the sound of her swallowing exaggerated in the silence. A picture came into my mind, rummaging through her dresser drawer, finding the pipe. "It wasn't the pipe that caused it," I said to her. "It was never the pipe." "No," she said. The skin on her face was rubbery and pouched, like small deflated balloons beneath her eyes. There was an expression in her eyes, though, the empty calm that follows catharsis. "Do you know what dead finger is, Jessie?" said Cat. I turned to her, startled. "What?" I sat there stupidly thinking she must be referring to Mother's finger in the jar on the counter. The room was utterly still. "Dead finger," she repeated. She said it with softness, with kindness. "It's a plant. It's from the nightshade family." She looked at me quizzically to see if I grasped her meaning. "It's very poisonous," she added. I understood instantly. My father had died from ingesting some kind of toxic plant. I stood up, shaking my head. How do you suddenly revise images and understandings you've carried in the cells of your body for 33 years? I walked to the counter and leaned on the worn wood, lowering my head into my hands. "Dead finger," I said, realizing the name had started all Mother's warped reasons for mutilating herself. Hepzibah came and stood beside me. She touched my shoulder. "It used to grow around the slave cemetery. It still crops up sometimes if I'm not careful. It's a shrub with fuzzy leaves and grayish-white blossoms shaped like fingers, and it has a terrible rotting odor. You've probably seen it on the island." "No," I said, still cradling my head, not wanting to picture it. "It's more merciful than other nightshades. Back in the 40s and 50s, people here used to put their pets out of their misery. Your father died peacefully, Jessie. He fell asleep, and he didn't wake up." I turned around to Mother, who appeared tranquil, but spent. "How did you know what to do? I didn't think you knew anything about plants." She didn't answer. What she did was to look at Cat and then at Hepzibah. "They had been part of it, too." "You helped her?" I said, looking from one to the other. Cat glanced at the floor, then back at me. "We did it because your father asked us. He came to each one of us, to Shem and Dominic, too, begging our help the same way he did your mother's. We loved Joe. We would have done anything for him, but none of us arrived at this easily." I looked at Dominic, confused. Why would my father make him part of this? Cat and Hepzibah, I understood. They were devoted to Mother, and Dad would have known how much she would need them afterward. Shem had been his best friend, but Dominic? He read my expression. "Come sit down," Dominic told me, and waited while I went and lowered myself into the chair. "Joe came to me one day and said he was going to die, that it would be a long, horrible death, and he couldn't put himself through it, much less his family. He said he would like to leave his life sitting in the mermaid chair. He wanted to sit in the holiest spot on the island, surrounded by his wife and his friends. Dominic couldn't have said anything in the world that would have surprised me more, or at the same time seemed more natural, truer to my father. "Your father was a charming man," he said. "He had what I would call an imaginative sense of humor, and he used it even then. He told me with a grin that God once sent real live mermaids to his boat, which he pointed out was surely a sign that when he died, he should be sitting in the chair holding on to them. But mostly, what he wanted was..." Dominic looked at Mother. "He wanted to sit in the chair because it needed to be a holy place for Nell's sake. I was supposed to be the officiant, you know, preside over his dying, give him last rites, then absolve Nell and the rest of us. I told him no at first. I was the last holdout." I was still trying to reconfigure my father's dying, change the pictures, the accompanying feelings. I tried to imagine him sitting in the mermaid chair, staring into Mother's face, slowly slipping into a coma. Had I been asleep in my bed while all of this happened? Had he come to my room to say goodbye? A fragment of memory hung in my head like a little green fruit that had never ripened. Opening my eyes, seeing him standing by my bed. The whirligirl he'd peeled for me earlier that evening sat browning on my bedside table, and I watched him reach out and touch it with his fingers. "Daddy?" My voice was woozy with sleep. "Shh," he said. "It's okay." He knelt on the floor and, sliding his arm under my shoulder, held me against his chest, my cheek crushed against the rough nap of his corduroy shirt. He smelled of pipe tobacco and apples. "Jessie," he said, "my little whirligirl." I was sure I heard the soft sound of his crying. He sang my name over and over, soft against my ear, before lowering me back to my pillow, back into the fuzzy world of my dreams. I'd always known these things had taken place. As a child, every time I'd sung my name across the empty marsh, I'd known. I just never understood until now that they'd happened on the night he died. I was holding the sides of my chair. I was trying to keep myself there. "Why did you change your mind?" I asked Dominic.
"Joe was determined," he said, "and not just charming, but shrewd. He let me know he was going to take his life whether I helped him or not, but that it would be so much better for Nell if I did. I realized I could either stand on dogma and turn my back, or I could take something terrible and inevitable and bestow a little mercy on it. I decided to try to help the situation."
I started to say the obvious, that gathering around a holy relic and Dominic's absolution of Mother hadn't helped her much in the end. But how did I know? Maybe it had kept her saner than she would have been otherwise. "The boat," I said. "Was he even on it?" Shem, who'd not said a word since we'd sat down, looked up at me with red-rimmed eyes.
"He was on it. I took him to his boat myself, that old Chris Craft of his, and laid him inside it. It was tied up at my dock."
The Jess Sea. It occurred to me suddenly that Shem had been involved not because he was a close friend, but because he knew how to make the boat explode, to make it seem like an accident. Shem looked at Mother as if asking whether he should go on. The last few minutes she'd been quiet and drawn into herself, sagged down into the chair.
"Nell," Shem said,
and she nodded at him. I watched him take a breath. As he exhaled, his chin quivered.
Joe had already filled the bilge with gasoline and tied the steering wheel, so it would take him straight out into the bay. That night, after I laid him down inside it, I cranked the boat and left it in neutral while I disconnected the battery cable. Then I throttled it up to 10 miles an hour and untied the boat cleat. When it hit choppy water, the loose cable began to bounce around and threw a spark. The boat exploded before it got 200 yards.
But why go to all those lengths just to make it look like an accident? That's crazy. Mother glared at me like her old combative self.
That was the most important thing to your father. He wanted it that way for you. So don't you dare say it was crazy.
I walked over and squatted beside her chair. It was a relief to me that she could be angry, that there was something left inside her. What do you mean he wanted it that way for me? She tilted her face down to mine, and I saw her eyes filling up again.
He said his dying would be hard on you, but living with his suicide would be 1,000 times worse. He couldn't bear your thinking he'd abandoned you.
The room grew quiet. Somewhere in the mangled remnants of childhood that were left inside me, I knew that what my father had done had been for me, for his Whirligirl, and I didn't know how to bear the weight of that, the merciless blame of his sacrifice. I closed my eyes and heard my father singing my name soft against my ear, singing his goodbye. Jesse, Jesse, Jesse. As long as he lived, he did not forget my name. I dropped my head straight down onto my mother's lap and sobbed my grief into her thin cotton skirt. I could feel the hard, lacy border of her slip press against my forehead. This was supposed to be about Mother, emptying out all the dark pockets inside and sorting the contents. It was supposed to be about her remembering things and maybe somehow putting her broken self back together. And it had come to this, to me, bent over her lap, her maimed hands coming up to rest on my head. When we stepped outside onto the sidewalk, the dark blue haze of dusk was everywhere. The mermaid chair's procession had already coursed along the street onto the dock. Climbing into the golf cart, I could see the crowd massed along the rails. I imagined the shrimp boats passing by out on the water, with colored lights wound along the raised nets. I pictured the mermaid chair, perched on its scrap of coral rug in all that soft, glittering light, freshly splashed and blessed. Mother sat beside me in the golf cart as we drove through the falling darkness, and did not remember she had left her finger on the counter in the store. Chapter 34. In May, the tides went to work hauling away the dead marsh grass. It drifted along the salt creeks like a constant flotilla of rotting, hay-brown rafts. Early in the mornings, when I knew I would be alone, I stole out to the dock in the rookery. I would stand there with the light soaring across the marsh, filling my nostrils with the egg and sperm smell, and watch the great floating exodus, the immaculate scouring way nature renews herself. After I'd learned how my father had died, there was a lifting away of sorrow. I can't explain that, except to say there's release in knowing the truth, no matter how anguishing it is. You come finally to the irreducible thing, and there's nothing left to do but pick it up and hold it. Then at least you can enter the severe mercy of acceptance. Mother seemed relieved to have the truth come out of its long hibernation. She went on confessing pieces of it to me, usually in the evenings when the day turned dark and grainy and sifted past the windows. She told me that Cat and Hepzibah had boiled batches of the plant leaves and chunks of the root, cooking them down to the consistency of pea soup. My father had insisted on drinking the brew from one of the chalices used during Mass. I'm sure he was trying to help my mother understand that dying is a sacrament, too, that there was holiness in the sacrifice he was making, though I'm sure she never understood it. I'm not at all sure I understood it completely. I didn't know if my father had horned in on God's territory and cut the thread that belonged to the fates, if he'd usurped what wasn't rightly his, the terrifying power to say when. Or did he only usurp God's deep heart, laying his life down as a sacrifice, wanting only to take away our suffering? I didn't know if it was hubris, or fear, or courage, or love, or all of them. In the night, I dreamed of whales thrusting their sickly bodies onto the shore to die willful deaths. At first I stood there bewildered, screaming for them to go back to the ocean. But in the end, I simply walked among them, running my hands along their mountainous backs, easing them toward the mystery they'd chosen. Mother said my father had held the chalice with both hands and gulped quickly. Later, Dominic had sent the cup with Shem to be placed on the boat, fearing that the poison might never be washed out of it. She told me that as he drank, she started to sob, but he'd